Thank you for joining us. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the 100th episode of the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook by searching The Fisheries Podcast or just Fisheries Pod. You can also support the podcast on Patreon with a monthly or one-time donation. A special thank you to Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John for doing just that, going onto our Patreon and donating as little as $1 a month to help support the podcast. If a monthly donation or one-time monetary donation isn't your thing, you can also support the podcast by visiting our store on Teespring, where you can find a variety of t-shirts featuring a podcast logo and a variety of different fish species, such as paddlefish, sturgeon, catfish, swordfish, anglerfish, and even a seahorse. For the next week, following the release of this episode until the end of the year, everything on our Teespring store is going to be 25% off to celebrate our 100th episode. Yes, you heard that right. 100 episodes.
Look at us. Hey, look at us.
Look at us.
Huh?
Who would have thought?
Not me.
Now, did I ever think that we would get to this point? I guess I honestly can't remember. The first year of the podcast was such a whirlwind. Releasing episodes every week by myself consumed a lot of time, as you can imagine. So much that it was hard to just sit back and enjoy the process of interviewing guests, and kind of worrying about where the next interview was coming from more than just enjoying who I was talking to. The show definitely wouldn't be where it is today without the contributions of great co-hosts that I've been very fortunate enough to be able to work with. So a huge thank you to Brett Kelly, Julie Vecchio, and Sue Colvin for stepping up and volunteering to help out on the show. And I have enjoyed listening to all the episodes that you guys have put out, and I'm sure the audience has appreciated the different set of voices featured on the show every month. Of course, we wouldn't be here without an audience, and I want to give a giant thank you to every single one of the listeners that have downloaded or listened to the show. Whether it's just one episode or if you listen to every episode as soon as it comes out on Sunday. So thank you, and thank you. We have had quite a ride over the past 27 months. We have interviewed 93 different guests across the previous 99 episodes, and we've covered a variety of topics from basic fish management to how otolith crystal structure affects microchemistry readings to peeling apart fisheye lenses to learn environmental history. And those episodes combined have received 46,500 downloads, or about 468 downloads per episode. I remember being excited when the first episode went over 100 downloads. So the show has definitely come miles since we first started. But let's take a trip down memory lane and see or hear exactly how the podcast started. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast aimed at spreading fisheries science to both scientists and the public. A few months back, I began to think, why isn't there a podcast for fisheries professionals? There is a podcast for nearly every topic, and honestly, I was a little upset that I couldn't find what I was looking for. But I didn't think I was the person that was going to begin recording podcasts. My idea didn't leave, though, and no one else picked up on it, so I began Googling what it took to do a podcast. The equipment, the content, the intestinal fortitude to put yourself out there, and I was, for some reason, surprised at how easy it was. Perhaps I was hoping it was a little more difficult so I could pass the buck on to somebody else. So that brings us up to last week, the 148th annual meeting of the American Fisheries Society that was held in Atlantic City. I finally arrived after a hectic day of traveling to my hotel the night before a scientific communication workshop with the podcast idea in my head. I was fully prepared to talk to someone, anybody, about it while I was in Atlantic City. The day of the workshop rolls around, and I may be the fifth person to show up to the workshop. Patrick Cooney of the Fisheries blog was one of the instructors, and he had sent out a few questions to us to answer before the class started, one of which was what you hope to gain from this workshop in 140 characters or less. And I answered, to become a better voice for my fellow fisheries biologist, because I'm tired of people thinking I'm a game warden. I don't know about you all in the marine world, but here in the Midwest, we're commonly mistaken for game wardens when we show up to a lake, and people think we're there to write them tickets rather than to sample and enhance their fisheries populations. And this was a topic that Joe Margraf brought up in his installation speech at 146. People just don't know what fisheries professionals do, and I'm hoping to fix that with this podcast. So back to the workshop. The workshop goes on, and we get to a point for questions. And a grad student from Arizona asked if the fisheries blog has given any thought to jumping over to podcast form or something very similar. And in my head, I was thinking, I'm not the only one. Someone else has this idea. And that got me curious. So the following morning, I sent out a tweet and asked a simple question. Hey, fisheries folks, how many of you would be interested in a fisheries podcast? And it was likely my most popular tweet in my 9-year, 1,000 tweet history on the app. It had gained 71 likes and 11 retweets, drawing attention from people that I viewed as fisheries social media pillars. So here I am, 1 week and 1,300 miles removed from AFS 148, recording the first podcast in a series that I hope continues well into the future. I plan to interview an expert of a certain fish species, genus, or technique every episode and ask them questions about those topics in a manner that scientists will be interested in, but also simple enough that any non-fisheries professionals would also be interested in. I had a professor at Iowa State whose teaching philosophy was that if you can't explain it to your Uncle Jack, then you don't truly understand it. Now, I'm not saying that we don't truly understand our science. I might not at times, but I'm sure somebody does. But more along the lines of, we haven't really tried too hard to explain it simply to people outside of our little bubble. And in the end, we need to realize that most, if not all, the science we do is for the public's benefit, and not just to please the members of the scientific community. As far as format goes, the podcast will likely be an interview format with different guests providing different input about each week's theme of a certain fish, principle, or technique. Episode topics will vary, but some will be based on time of year and holidays. I also plan to highlight any fisheries conferences that I am aware of, as well as keep people up to date on deadlines. That is, if I can keep track of all of them myself. As of right now, the plan is to have an episode once a week and have each episode be about 30 minutes long. But this is a learning experience for me, so episodes could be a little longer, a little shorter. They could be a little more spread out once every 2 weeks. It all depends on the guest availability, if I can find someone to talk to, or if I want to talk about stuff by myself for 30 minutes. If you are interested in partaking, but are intimidated, don't be. As scientists, we have been trained to give highly technical presentations to a room full of people who are often smarter or more experienced than ourselves, or at least they think they are. And we don't think twice about that. So come on the show, tell me your story, and we will spread science together. Now for a PSA, I have never gone on or recorded a podcast before, so there may be a bit of a learning curve on my end going into this. So bear with me through the beginning, and hopefully this will turn into a really fun way to communicate what we actually do, and maybe down the road people will quit asking me if I'm going to write them a ticket. It's always weird listening back to older episodes that I've done, or older recordings, or I guess just listening back to anything that your voice is recorded. You aren't used to hearing your own recorded voice, so everything always just seems weird and different and not right. And I guess that was the biggest hurdle of what I went through when I started the podcast, was just talking into a microphone and thinking a lot about what people would think about my voice. Maybe I didn't think I had the best voice to do a podcast, but regardless, we've put out 99 episodes and this is number 100, so people must be enjoying it. And I've definitely enjoyed hearing my guests that come on. We've had 93 different guests that have come on and braved that same barrier that I have. I mean, it's really no different than talking on the phone with a friend. And we've been doing this over Zoom. Everyone's comfortable with Zoom now. So what's the difference between hopping on Zoom and talking with family members, or hopping on Zoom and talking with somebody else about fish for a half hour or an hour? And we've had a handful, 93 people that have been brave enough to do just that. Many of them before some might have known what Zoom was. And so when I thought of what I would do for a 100th episode, I thought, what better than to do a best of episode? So I sat down and I thought, oh, it shouldn't be too hard. I'll dig through all the past episodes and pull out clips of questions I enjoyed asking or answers I enjoyed hearing. And pretty soon I started to realize that was a pretty monumental task, one, and two was, who am I to choose what my favorite answer or favorite questions were? That I mean, there's 467 more people that listen to each episode than me, so who am I to select the best ofs? So then I thought, maybe since I'm going through these episodes, maybe I'll pull out answers or questions that were centered around themes such as communication or equality or just some general advice. But those were quickly getting way too large to be put out in any sort of conglomeration best of episode like this. So those might be released as separate themed episodes later on as recycled content. We'll see how much, I guess it will take me a few weeks to get over putting this episode together. It's still a lot of work digging through the episodes I did. But like I've probably said too many times already in the short 10 minutes, we've interviewed 93 different people, and each one of them is working on a multitude of amazing projects, and they're all amazing people, and they all gave amazing answers. So how could I just choose a handful of those from that? So instead of me selecting which ones were my favorite, I just pulled out what their favorite memories were from their careers. So let's take a listen and hear back on what some of the favorite memories of our past guests were.
My favorite memory is seeing all of my graduate students go on and do good things.
Fish know no boundaries, especially when you're looking up here in the Great Lakes. And so developing the relationships and the partners with the different academic and resource agencies has been a highlight of my career, and never would have thought I would have been as involved with it as I have. And it makes it worth getting up in the morning.
You know, I think my favorite memory probably came from the first time I actually caught an adult sturgeon in a gill net in the wild. We were setting nets in the Santee River in South Carolina. We were pulling it in and we felt a pretty solid tug on the net, and we had spent a lot of time not catching fish. So to feel something tug in the net was quite a surprise. And then to see the size of the fish was even better.
It's kind of feeling right around whenever I got my first paper accepted into a scientific journal. It's kind of the point where I realized that, okay, you know, you went from, okay, I'm just standing on this riverbank watching fish spawn, you know, taking notes. It really, anybody can do this. You know, you read these scientific papers, they're so technically written, and they're written by all these names of people that you see that are somewhat famous. And you realize that, well, you know, this really is for everybody. Anybody can do science.
It's been the field work, off of New England here. And that's really how I cut my teeth in marine biology and fish biology.
We're going around the lake, and I saw my very first bald eagle in the wild. I had never seen that before. And I thought, okay, we're taking sonar surveys. We're doing stuff for our internship, and we're doing stuff in the field of fisheries. And here I see this bald eagle, and I'm just like, my life is complete.
I've had a lot of memorable moments from trying to net a walleye that I know was over the state record of 22 pounds at the time and closer to 25 pounds. I'll never forget that image of her sinking as I was trying to get two dip nets around her. But one of my favorite moments was just, I was recognized by the Professional Anglers Association years ago. It was at that point that I realized, you know, what I was doing here was really truly making a difference out there.
My favorite memory, honestly, it has to be when my daughter was helping me stock ponds and she couldn't get enough of wanting to help dad help one of the clients out. She thought it was an awesome thing to do.
There's been a lot of great moments. You know, some of them have been my moments. Some of them have been my students' moment when they had their opportunity to shine. There's been a lot of really great high points, but I will say one project that I'm especially proud of is work that I did when I was with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game to help resolve a problem that we had encountered with a new hatchery that had come online to produce Snake River sockeye salmon smolts. And in the hatchery, the fish looked beautiful, but they really struggled when the fish were released. And we were able to do a series of experiments to kind of narrow down the possible contributing factors. But we ultimately were able to determine that there was a pretty major difference in water chemistry between the hatchery and the release site where we were taking these smolts. Once we mitigated for that problem, then the program really seemed to be taking off. And this past year had great success. So I would say that's probably one of easily my top five moments, if not the top moments so far in my career. Being able to work with smart people, dedicated people, and to be able to focus on a really important issue and ultimately use good solid science to solve a problem.
I was working for the U.S. Forest Service, and I got the opportunity to help on a native fish restoration project in Yellowstone National Park, Grayling Creek in particular. It was a rote gnome project. There was a permanent barrier built into the stream. And we were part of the initial crew to remove all non-natives from that fishery. I believe it was in 2014. But anyway, we were in the backcountry using rote gnome to remove all the non-natives from this fish. Way in the backcountry, the helicopter gear in. We actually had camp chefs. I've never had that. It was wild. But it was just hard work, and they're trying to, you know, keep the crew happy, long days, you know, and then this is backcountry, you know, pepper spray with bears, messing around in camp and no trail stuff. It was just a really, really special experience. And it's kind of formed how or what I'd like to work on in the future.
Oh, there's so many. I'd say most of them have to do with being out in the field with my field crew, doing the research, getting to spend the summers hanging out around the Great Lakes, jumping into wetlands, sinking into wetlands more so. I don't know if there's a specific memory I have, but just the camaraderie with my team of other grad students, technicians, all of us working towards our goal, and that, you know, getting the data and sampling and really exploring some amazing places.
It's being able to work up in the beautiful, pristine lakes of Alaska in the summers, where we have lots of fish. And, you know, it's just a beautiful habitat. I've been started out 25 years ago, taking my wife and my kids up there. And now my wife and my grandkids come up with me.
It's seeing the next generation pick this up and go with it, because it's not a short-term game. It's forever, the stewardship. And in that is my own two children. I have two teenagers, and they're both really interested in the environment.
I would have to say that my favorite memory, probably my most proud memory, is probably the way to say it, was, yeah, as most folks have been to graduate school, and when you finally finish and you actually get out of school and you're not that, you know, career student anymore, that was probably my best memory of my career, was the day that, you know, my dissertation was accepted and I was really done, and I could really actually get out in the workforce and start doing some research as a professional instead of a student.
One of my favorite memories was sampling stream fish in Virginia and coming upon a couple of hellbenders, and that was a creature I had never encountered until that moment. I think that was a pretty cool experience for me.
Mine is actually getting to start my career in fisheries.
I would say that my favorite memories are the opportunities that I got. You know, I started my career as a GS-2, I believe, at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, one of the lowest grades you can get, and then moving up to becoming a senior executive service and the head of fisheries in this country. All of the positions were great. Memories are the ones where I got a chance to go and visit fisheries biologists out there working hard to make sure that they protect and recover aquatic species.
Attending a Desert Fishers Council meeting in Cuatro Ciénaga, it's a series of freshwater springs that are home to this really unique fauna and flora, has three endemic turtles and eight species of endemic fish and a number of endemic snails. And we had the opportunity to go out there and swim with the fish and see a very unique part of the world.
There's this one bend on the river called Pinhook Bend. You had to drive a long ways, and then you had to get in the boat, and you had to drive a long ways, and it was just a bend that nobody really wanted to sample. Well, we went, and for the life of me, I can't remember if it's gill nets or trammel nets, but we were out there running them, you know, on our day off, just having a good time, and ended up catching this pallid sturgeon, and it was hooked right on the backside of its rostrum, and they have a little tiny hook back there, and this fish was just dangling. And it was the first mature pallid sturgeon I'd ever seen, you know, and I was still in that state of flux where I was kind of working for a job, not so much as a career. And it really opened my eyes to see this 3 foot long dinosaur, you know, and something that I'd heard of, but there hadn't been very many mature sturgeon caught on the river at that point. So we kind of walked back with our chest puff out, feeling like heroes. Again, netting in Nebraska at one point. I bet it snowed a foot while we were out there getting gill nets. So we got our gill nets, and it took a few hours, and the snow was just unbelievable. The flakes were huge. It was coming down fast. And trying to get the boat trailer up the ramp that day was the memory that really sticks out the most in my head. And we made it. without losing a boat or anything.
I remember one summer I was working on the Lower Yellowstone in Montana at their paddlefish fishery, and it was a pretty slow year for catching wise, but the river was coming up and you could kind of tell that the next day was going to be good. So I figured I'd go out in the morning, and it was just one of those sort of mystical mornings on the river with a real dense fog, and it was cool, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't bitter cold or anything, and kind of just being out there in the river, and you could hardly see anybody next to you. And that's when I landed my first paddlefish.
What always stands out to me is, you know, the most vivid memory, and probably one of those moments where I decided, okay, I'm in this fisheries thing for real, and I wouldn't be doing this otherwise, was back in grad school. I'm out on a backwater on the Arizona side of the Colorado River, and it's in the middle of the night, and I'm running a 150-foot trammel net on a 10-foot John boat by myself in the rain with a headlamp, and it's pouring, and I'm leaning over the side of the boat trying to yank my trammel net out of a tree. And I think at that moment, it dawned on me that this is a crazy job, and I'm absolutely doing this because it's important to me to collect these data. And this, that kind of set the stage for me to say, I care about fisheries. I care about studying fish that have importance and that need managing. And that was kind of one of those awe-inspiring moments for me, not because the conditions were great, but because they were terrible and dangerous, and got me set on my way to the career I'm in now.
My favorite memory is the deep sea trawling trip that I went on. So both the actual invitation to go on the trip itself and the event as it was going on. It's so much more different seeing deep sea fishes alive and fresh compared to looking at museum preserved specimens, and just knowing that the organisms that you're bringing up are from the deep, deep parts of the ocean. It's a trip that I'll never forget.
So we were sampling for Topeka Shiners on this project here at Iowa State, and we were on a stream that we just, historically there had been Topeka Shiners, but we had done a couple sites for the study and we couldn't find them anywhere. We couldn't find them. And we had one last site of the summer, my last field season. I said, okay, this is our last chance. And we electrofished through it, didn't get anything. We're sanding up through, and we saw this one little kind of side channel that was this slack water, which is perfect Topeka Shiner habitat. And me and my tech looked at each other and we said, if we're going to find a Topeka Shiner on this stream, it's going to be in that pool. And we seined through it and we pulled it up. And sure enough, we saw that little red fin that shows us the Topeka Shiner. And then we found a female, so a reproducing pair, hopefully. So we were able to call that, successfully found Topeka Shiners on that stream. So they didn't decline. So I was super pumped about that. And for whatever reason, that stuck with me.
As much as I love field work, I would probably say the most memorable time in my time in fisheries is really once all the field work is done and you get to sit down and see what really create something from all the data you collected and kind of start to see results and start to get answers. So
I mentioned earlier, not being from here and not even knowing what the driftless area was at the time, just being able to be like fully immersed in it and drive around and see all the bluffs and the cold water streams was cool. But there was one day in particular where it was towards the later part of the summer, and we were sort of trying to find brook trout sites at that point. You know, we were sort of striking out at a lot of places in the earlier part of the summer and getting a little discouraged. But there was one day when we went to a private landowner's property that had about 10 different springs on it. You know, it was really nice cobble bottom and really cold water. And you're just going through this tiny stream that was less than a meter wide. And then, you know, we were almost to the end of our transect and about to pack it in for the day, and it was starting to rain. And we come upon like this big pool. And so we had not sampled any brook trout up to that point, and it was about 150 meters or so sampled thus far. And then we get into that pool and I sink right up about to my wader's limit and, you know, in the pool. And all of a sudden we sample 5 adult brook trout all over 10 inches. And that was one of the coolest days of the summer, you know.
So I mentioned earlier, I had a chance to go on that NOAA bottom longline cruise. It was really the first chance I had to sort of get my hands involved with real research. And from that, I think one experience that stands out was, you know, we're down there doing this longline survey. And the way this works is, as you're pulling the longline in, if you have a shark on, you'll take the gangen off, and then one of the crew will guide the shark into a hydraulic cradle where we can do all of our sampling safely for both the shark and ourselves. And you know, I was watching this process go, I was taking data the whole nine yards, and the next thing I knew it, I had a gangen in my hand and I had a bull shark on the other end of the line.
There was a disease that kind of cropped up. It's viral hemorrhagic septicemia. And as a result of that, we had to do a lot of monitoring to see if we could detect any of the disease. And my crew was a little bit short. And so I had a daughter that was in high school at the time. And so I managed to talk her into going out and lifting some northern pike trap nets with me. And so my daughter's job was to, first of all, to help me lift the trap nets and then bring all these pike back. And then I had her holding the bag while I was pulling kidneys and spleens out of these dead fish. And we were kind of gabbing. And at some point, she just kind of looked at me. And now consider that this was a high school girl. She just kind of looked at me and said, "Dad," she says, "you've got the coolest job in the world."
I can remember the very first paddle trip that we did with partners on the South Llano, when all of this was still just very conceptual. But we organized a paddle trip just to go down the river, talk about conservation challenges and talk about capacity within our organizations and what we can bring to the table. And, you know, it really surpassed any expectation. I don't know that I would have believed that it would have, everything would have come together and just fallen in place the way that it has. And it's really been a cool success story for us that now we're trying to replicate in other areas of the state.
It's probably looking at that first otolith section from Big Mouth Buffalo and seeing, at first thinking it was only 8 to 12 years old because there were that many fractures roughly in the otolith, and then coming back to it the next day and realizing that, it could potentially be over 80 years old.
I guess my favorite memory is watching Gila trout go back to Arizona for the first time.
I have this nice memory of being in a Norwegian hatchery and seeing a guy, he's probably in his 40s, he'd come in to do an interview with us and to just do his regular hatchery chores. And he brought along his daughter, and I think she was maybe 7 or 8. And it was just so cool to see them work as a team, that she loved the fish. She'd look into the tank and say hello to them. She kind of treated them like they were her personal pets in a way. And just watching her sprinkle a little feed in the tank and scoop a little of, you know, the debris from the surface of the water, and then just watch them stand there together and point into the tank and talk about the fish, and just the smile on their faces. You know, that was a really cool experience to see that and really get to feel the love that people have for fish in whatever way that they're getting to engage with them.
I've decided that my favorite memory is seeing Clear Lake get better. I mean, it used to be really dirty, dingy, brown, and green, and it's getting clearer. It's getting cleaner. Maybe my favorite memory was being out there probably 3 or 4 springs ago, fishing in waders on a May morning and catching 12-inch crappies off of a cattail bed out in the little part of Clear Lake. And no one didn't used to catch crappies here. Can catch them here now. And it's because of the work that a lot of people did to clean this thing up, and enjoying the heck out of that, because it wasn't just one little thing, but a lot of things that really, really made the difference there.
So one that always comes to mind is the first time we go to Sample Lake of the Ozarks for paddlefish. We made it up there late afternoon at 4 or 5 o'clock. We were going to just set nets to see how it would go. So we set four or five nets, and what we didn't expect was to just load the nets full of paddlefish that night. And we were out on the water till 2 or 3 in the morning, pulling fish out of the nets and taking data from them. So it was sore back and late night.
Just the whole experience of working in this national fish hatchery system, there is a group of dedicated people out there that every single day are just putting their hearts and souls into trying to make fisheries a better place in the country.
I've been blessed to travel the world and work across the world. Living in Alaska was great. Some of the experiences I had up there, working in Africa, seeing certain portions of Mexico that I didn't even know Mexico looked like that. But for me, I think working in the Amazon, driving a boat on the Amazon River was a truly unique experience.
Probably my favorite memory so far has just been working with all these different fishermen that have been helping me out. Everyone has been above and beyond gracious and helpful. And I also feel like after I leave these places that not only have I found some great people to work with, but I've also made some really good lifelong friends.
Probably the first time I saw a paddlefish, I about passed out. I had no idea what that even was. Seeing a sturgeon for the first time was kind of similar. And then when I saw an American eel a few years ago, it had been on my life list because I should have been able to see it in many places and many times. And we just don't catch them because they're really rare. And so that was a pretty exciting moment, I would say.
Working in Dry Tortugas National Park, that is just an incredibly special place. The reefs are pristine and in fabulous shape. There are large fish everywhere. And it's so remote and it's so amazing to be snorkeling and diving and fishing in this area that is just so, still so pristine. And then also just anytime I'm at sea, offshore on a boat, especially a sailing boat, sailing at night, engine off, it's pretty special.
I just remember the day being out on the boat with everybody and we were watching that dissolved oxygen meter and we were just watching the dissolved oxygen tank and we were like, I think we just figured out why paddled sturgeon don't recruit. I gotta also say, in terms of memories, it's just the students. The students have made my career. And it's so fun being around the students and just that energy and the creativity.
So one of the first days is right when we were resetting the last trot line, we got waked by a fishing boat that came by. And so when I was handing one of the biologists a trot line hook to put on, the boat jerked and one of the circle hooks went like right up into my palm. And we were just like, oh, and it was right at the end, so it was fine. But I got back to the office and the first thing I did was go to our supervisor and be like, hey, I really love doing this. I promise I'm okay. I'm getting the hook taken out of my hand in the ER. Please don't take me off the project. I'll be back tomorrow.
I distinctly remember the moment when we realized that shoal bass were so different. And so I was doing an exploitation study on these fish in the Flint River. And then I remember distinctly the following March. And I would start taking these phone calls. This guy's catching this. He catches fish. I'm like, oh, wow, you catch it. I caught it up here. Okay, that's cool. You know, and then I'd hang up the phone. And I'd look up the fish. And I'm like, holy crap, we tagged that fish 60 miles downstream where that guy caught it. And the next guy calls, and he's like, I caught this fish here. And then at this point, I'm like, okay, let me look it up while I'm on the phone with you. Oh, that fish was caught 70 miles downstream. And it was that way the whole spring. And by the end of the spring, I had fish that were 150 miles down upstream of where I'd tagged them. I'm like, holy mackerel.
I share an office with two colleagues, another engineer, and I mentioned my collaborator earlier, Rob Lusardi. He's a fish ecologist, and he kind of picks up on a body of knowledge where mine ends. And we have been working together for a long time. We didn't really know each other very well before we did, but now we pretty much collaborate on every project we ever work on together. And the other day he came into the office and he just stood there and he was like, you know what? You are my best friend. I was just so thrilled because I love working with him too.
It was mentoring the young biologists that came on board.
I truly enjoy working with and for the people. Of course, not all the people. We always have some that are more challenging than others, but really seeing people utilize and enjoying the facilities that I'm responsible for.
Maybe the coolest thing I ever observed in the field was in a spawning population of bull trout up in Rapid River in the headwaters of that drainage. Very large bull trout, up to 30 inches long, were spawning in a stream about 10 feet wide, and they were completely oblivious to us. We were able to walk amongst them while they were spawning, and we were watching big males fighting over the females. And driving, you know, the main male was driving other male competitors away. But then little tiny males would sneak in and spawn with the female over and over again. And we watched one male outwitted, a 25-inch male, outwitted by a 6-inch little resident male a dozen times. Another competitor male would approach. The silly big male drove it away. And the little brook trout, or the little bull trout, jumped up between two rocks, hopped up and spawned with the female, and the big one was never the wiser. And we talked about that ever since.
going to the Apostle Islands to help sample was incredible. It's just so beautiful up there. And it was one of the earlier fieldwork experiences for me because a lot of my previous work was lab work and I had wanted grad school to open the door to more fieldwork. And that was just kind of all my hopes and dreams of grad school coming together into a cool project and a cool place and actually doing the type of research and the using methodology that I had always dreamed of.
It's hard to pick, but definitely one of them would be the first time I was snorkeling amongst mangrove roots and seeing all the fish and just realizing what amazing life is there in and amongst the mangroves.
So I've had a lot of moments in my office. I'm just writing something up even, and I'm just like trying to make all these connections and trying to figure out these different missing species. And I just shout like, I figured it out or something like that in the hallway. And so those I really like. But I think my favorite moment is just when I found the mummy chugs in the hallway, and it didn't become like, let me try to think of a research question that other people may find interesting. It was, this is something that I want to find out. I want to find out why that fish is in the hallway. And I researched it and I published on all that information. And just because I have my own question that I want to answer.
I have to, you know, give 1,000 shout outs to my wife, Casey David, for putting up with me in general, but just all the gar puns and all the gar stuff and everything. We met at Chet Aquarium in Chicago, and she was a grants person there, and I was a postdoc there. And so really, you know, we got to know each other around a bunch of other fishes and everything. And so she kind of knew what she was getting into. But probably one of my favorite memories was from my 40th birthday. She surprised me with what we now call Gar Trek 40, where we went to a bunch of different springs and rivers in Florida. And we were able to see a bunch of longnose and Florida gars. And she was a trooper. She put up with kayaking and all kinds of stuff on multiple days. And she was pregnant at the time too, but it was just amazing to see so many fish. We captured it on video. Like, I mean, it was crystal clear water and more gars than I've ever seen. We called it Garvana, if you will. I think at the end of the actual day of my birthday, we got out of the kayak. We'd seen all these gars and stuff, and she was very supportive. I said, you know what? We're allowed to swim in the spring. I got to swim, you know, with these gars and everything like that. So I just had a mask. I didn't even have a snorkeling, you know, tube or anything like that. And so basically put that on and was able to swim with these gars for, you know, just a little short time. And I had a GoPro with me. And so that was kind of surreal to, like, you know, celebrate my birthday with something she put together alongside these, like, just giant longnose gars. Like, there were 4 footers, 4.5 footers, maybe some close to 5 feet. And they were, you know, they weren't bothered by me at all or anything like that.
I worked on a project in the Grand Canyon, and it was on the Little Colorado, and we used a helicopter. And so we were able to helicopter in and out, and just the scenery and people I was with, and just the beautiful blue water, because it was the sunlight bounces off the travertine when it's not turbid, and it's just this beautiful emerald blue, really light blue color that you wouldn't think would be in the desert.
I was somebody's make-a-wish. That it was a sick child, and that when he was hooked up to machines in the hospital, his mom would read him tweets that I'd been writing and read him articles that I had shared. And his make-a-wish was, I want to go see sharks with Why Sharks Matter, when I was a graduate student. Like, that was intense. It turns out we later moved. I did my postdoc in the city where this kid and his family live. And they helped us get our amazing apartment. They put us in touch with a realtor who knew a guy. And it's so these people have remained part of my life. But it was for everyone who was on that trip, they said it was their favorite trip, because it was just so moving to see how much this kid and his family appreciated the chance to do something like this.
We had a project where we were doing some marine biology. And we were doing this out at the submarine base at Bangor. And they had moved the nuclear subs over to, they cleared some areas for a sub bay, and they restored salmon habitat in this other area. And so they did not trust us scuba diving around the nuclear subs, as you might imagine. And so they sent us out there, and they sent us out there with the EOD guys. These guys are the underwater frogman. They put explosives on ships, and they take care of mines in the water and everything, about as tough as you can get. Imagine some of the Navy SEALs. And so they would go out with us, and then we'd go out and we would be out with us and they'd have to keep an eye on us. And they, we'd go underwater and we'd collect a lot of these small leaves and invertebrates and we'd bring them to the top after a dive and they go, what are you guys doing down there anyway? And so, it was one of the funniest things was trying to explain what we were doing, collecting all these little leaves and plankton and this, little small fish to these guys whose business was blowing up ships and taking care of mines. It took us a little while to do that, but we were able to finally get that squared away with them.
I spent a couple years living in, or I guess a couple of seasons living and working in interior Alaska. And a project I was a part of for both of those years was working on the Susitna. And every single workday, I was getting to see the world from like all these different vantage points, from like being down on my knees and like scrubbing algae off of a rock to like cradling a huge grayling and flushing its stomach. And then, you know, we'd be jet boating around. And then to get back to camp, we'd be helicoptered back to camp. And so, you know, I was seeing this system from its like smallest cells up to this whole landscape view all in a given workday.
I think it's the first time I saw a live shark in the wild up close. This beautiful big blue shark came on board and we put her on the table. And Brendel told us before, look at them in the eye, just take a second to realize how present they are and how smart they are. Like you can just see it in their eyes. And I was like, okay, yeah, yeah. And then when I was on the boat, I did it and I just couldn't believe it. Like I felt like I was actually understanding how these species have been on Earth for so long, longer than trees. That's my favorite shark fact.
Being out in the field. So actually yesterday and last Thursday were my first times back in the field since COVID hit. And so, you know, I think a lot of us get into this field because we enjoy the resource, we enjoy fishing, that sort of thing. And I think being out in the field is just an integral part of what we do. And so really any of those opportunities are really, I really appreciate them.
I love when a bunch of us get out in the field together and get to go fishing and you realize that all of us are doing this working in fisheries because we just love the work and love going out and catching these fish and shellfish and seeing them and holding them and seeing who can catch the biggest one or the most.
I was snorkeling and I was measuring some sponges and we were taking some samples from one of our field sites and I was looking at this clump of sponges and I could identify like the basics of all of them except one, which was very smooth, like smoother than I was used to seeing. And it was brownish gray and it had spots on it. And I thought, that is a weird looking sponge. Like I have never seen a sponge like that. So I was excited because I was like, oh, we found one we haven't seen in this area before. And so I was going to take a sample of it. And I reached out to hold the sponge so that I can take a sample. And the sponge looks at me, which sponges don't have eyes, so that was my first clue. And it starts to get up out of the pile and swim away, and it was a shark. It was a nurse shark hiding underneath this pile of sponges.
One of the happiest times in my life was the month that I spent in Guinea in West Africa, traveling in a new country to see fish that I had only ever seen in jars or in textbooks. The first fish I ever caught in Africa was a bitcher, a polypterity. And I couldn't, my brain wouldn't let me say the correct identifier because no, that's only in the textbooks. You'd never actually catch that. And so that was a good start to an incredible month of fieldwork.
I'm going to have to say that my favorite memory linked to what I've done in marine science is meeting my amazing girlfriend. We actually met in New Jersey working that recreational fishing survey. We met on a party boat called the Dauntless out of Point Pleasant, New Jersey. It was the first party boat she ever worked on. And the first thing I ever said to her was, I hope you have Dramamine because this is the only boat in the state that makes me vomit. And then we both continued talking after we met on that boat, found out we were both interested in going to grad school. And fast forward to now as we actually live together, she is also pursuing her master's at Old Dominion, working with Caribbean king crabs.
I enjoy teaching. I enjoy all the things I do at the university, but working with the agencies, working with managers like Jason, like the managers I work with in the other states, I feel like managers, and I've said this before, managers have a tougher job than professors do. they have the tough job. They're trying to manage the fish in a very complex socioeconomic environment. So working with the managers, being able to assist them, working with them as equals, where they can tell me if they think I'm wrong and I can tell them if I think they're wrong. That's what the kind of relationship Jason and I have. That's the kind of relations I have with the other states. That's been the most enjoyable thing. And that's been happening year in and year out. And that's what I look back on as number one.
Like I said before, one of the reasons I enjoy doing this podcast is just getting to talk to the variety of people that I do and getting to hear the passion that they have for their job and why they love doing their job. And you can tell from some of these favorite memories of just how special of a job it is. Yeah, I know when I was interviewed back in episode 58 when Julie and Brett took over, they asked me the same five questions that I ask each of my guests. And I believe I said my favorite memory at that time was looking back on my times on the Mississippi River and just being out on the sandbars looking for petrified wood or digging through the log jams looking for treasures that floated down the river and just hanging out with my fellow graduate students on the river doing some amazing field work on some amazing fish. But when I had stepped away from the podcast, I had a lot of time to reflect, and I almost immediately regretted stepping away, but I knew I had other things to do. And I remember mowing the yard listening to that last episode that I put out, episode 57 with Ryan Robert, and just thinking, man, I'm going to miss this. I'm going to miss talking to all these people and sharing their stories with my audience. And so my answer to what is your favorite memory has definitely changed. It's being able to talk to all of the amazing guests that I've been able to talk to in these episodes throughout this podcast. So, and I'm definitely looking forward to talking to the next 100 guests that come on the show and the 100 after that, and just getting to talk to as many fisheries professionals and hearing as many amazing stories about amazing and terrific projects. And if you couldn't tell from all their answers of what their favorite memories were, that a lot of these people are really, really enjoying their jobs. And another one of those questions I ask right after what is your favorite memory is, what is your dream job? So let's listen back and I guess get some validation that, yes, this is a dream job for a lot of people.
I think I am my dream job, man. I've got exactly what I want. The dream location is wherever I am.
I'd say I'm probably there. In terms of a fishery biologist's dream, in terms of interacting with stakeholders and the resource, this is pretty good in my book.
Definitely what I'm doing now, it's a realized dream job, being able to do my research and work with great students like Josh and the rest of our folks here. It really is a dream come true. And definitely this is a dream location, you know.
Well, I kind of have a dream job.
I have my dream job, I think.
Pretty hard to do better than I've done. I've been really lucky at several turns in my career, and I'm in a really great department with great colleagues, and I've had the opportunity to work in lots of interesting places. The only person whose biography I'm jealous of is Chuck Yeager, but. let's just say I'm pretty happy the way things have turned out for me.
You're right. I do enjoy completely the job I have. This really is my dream job. I know I fully expected as a graduate student and budding professional to probably take two or three or four jobs before I actually found the one I wanted to stick with for my career. I think that's pretty common. To get, you know, folks to get in the workforce and get their feet wet and get a little experience and then kind of migrate their way to the place or agency or you know, job that they really want to spend the rest of their career at and maybe retire at even. I, on the other hand, was very lucky and actually got my dream job right out of school. And, you know, I've been here 12 years and I don't plan on going anywhere.
Man, I think right now I've got the job that I've always dreamed of, which is to do research and have that research inform fisheries management. And that's extremely satisfying to me to be able to see projects through from inception to publication and all steps in between and be able to use that research to inform real management decisions that affect affect people who fish and fish populations in the state of Ohio where I grew up. So I really couldn't be happier, and really couldn't ask for much more than what I'm doing right now.
It's very cliche, but I'm in it.
You know, I think I'm in it right now. You know, if it all went away today, I would have to try to find something that sort of ticked all those boxes, where I have the creativity and the freedoms and sort of the respect that I need to get my job done. And I have all that now, and I'm very fortunate.
I actually am about to start my dream job. So working with Salmonid in the Pacific Northwest was something I always wanted to do, really, since kind of undergrad, starting to learn about fisheries. I was always like, I want to go there. And, you know, now that I'm going to go to Central Oregon, I get the chance to experience that. So I'm super pumped about that.
So I'm kind of living the dream right now.
Yeah, this is a great gig, and I'm blessed to be working here with a great group of colleagues. So I can't think of another job that I'd rather be in.
Sometimes it's hard to imagine that it's actually my job. You know, I kind of have my dream job at the moment. I hope I get to do this sort of thing forever, that this is just very much what I love to do.
I think I landed it, and I got really lucky so early in my career to do that.
This is my dream job, and I hope to continue to grow it into my dream job.
I'm currently living it, and every day I go to work, it's a blessing. I've never really had a bad day in my 17 years here at the Natural History Survey.
I think pretty much here doing what I'm doing. I love where I work. I love what I'm doing. I love Knoxville and the area around here. It's beautiful.
I'm sitting in it. Yeah, I think the best job and the best location. So yeah, I'm the third assistant unit leader at the co-op unit here in Montana. And it's been around since the 60s. So this people don't leave this position. They retire from this position, or my predecessor actually is now the unit leader, Dr. Al Zale. And so people don't leave. This is a beautiful place.
It's hard to beat this. Well, you know, I think I have my dream job now. I've had a number of dream jobs in my career. Each time I thought I had my dream job.
I'm living it, Nick. I mean, I would say, you know, what I'm doing right now, I mean, is definitely my dream job.
I think I've found a home here at Illinois River Biological Station, and work with some great people, and, you know, got a lot of freedom to pursue our research interests, and got a great team there at the station to, you know, shoot ideas off of. And I think I'm living it. So.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm in my dream job. I love it.
You know, I never really thought about dream job or location for the longest time, just because, again, I was happy wherever I was, as long as I was doing fisheries, I was happy. But I have to say, this is being here on an island with crystal clear blue waters and being able to dive for work. This is taking the cake. I'll have to say that. This is now my like favorite place, even though sometimes I really do miss Michigan. I mean, I loved Michigan. It was beautiful. But this place, I'm living the dream here for sure.
Yeah, I definitely feel I'm part of a lucky crew in that I pretty much have my dream job.
My dream job is a job that lets me hang out and ask all the fishy questions that I want to ask at the pace that I want to ask them at. And right now, I am in my dream location.
I feel like I've sort of been doing my dream job for a while.
You know, a lot of people wondered why I went to Oklahoma and on the Great Plains and other places when I was out here in the Great Northwest. And about all I can say is that the nice thing about fisheries is that everywhere you go, there's neat fish and interesting problems everywhere, every state. And I have no particular place where I'd necessarily like to be or settle. I enjoy working in Oklahoma every bit as much as I enjoy working in Idaho or Montana or Iceland or Colorado or wherever else I've worked. And I don't know if I have a dream place. I don't know if I have a dream job, but I do know that as a fishery biologist, we have two clients. We have the people and then we have the fish. And I like doing things for the fish. They need representation. And I like working with people like Jason and other people that also care about the fish. So it doesn't matter where I'm doing it, work in fisheries. Anywhere you're working out there, I would say if you look a little bit, you'll find what you like.
This podcast has nothing to do with my day-to-day job. I don't get paid to put these episodes out. I do this all out of my own pockets because it is a dream for me to just be able to sit down and talk with all these different fisheries professionals and hear their stories and hear their passions. And we've listened to 30 minutes of guests telling their favorite stories of just how special this field is. And that results in the past 10 minutes that we listened to of 30 plus fisheries professionals saying that this is their dream job. And I think almost every person that we interviewed that was asked the question that wasn't a student or a freshly graduated student answered that they were in their dream job and or their dream location. And I think Dr. Dennis Garnecchia put it perfectly in his answer that everywhere you go, there are interesting fish and interesting problems. And no matter where you land, you're going to be able to find something that you're going to be interested in, and you're going to develop a passion for it, and you're going to love working on what you're doing. And just that passion comes through, and it's hard not to share your passions, and I enjoy hearing from those passionate people. So like I mentioned earlier, we've interviewed 93 people. You've probably all have that number memorized because I've said it 10 million times, but all 93 of those people that we've had on the podcast show have been passionate, and I could probably rattle off most of the guests that I've done in order just because that's how much it sticks in my mind. How much of an impression they've made on me just coming on the show, most of them volunteering to come on the show and share their passions. And it's truly been special. So thank you to all the past guests, and I look forward to talking to the next 100. So if you're a passionate person, passionate about your job, come on the podcast, send us an email at beaguest@thefisheriespodcast.com. We'd love to have you on and hear about your research, hear about your life, hear about your background, hear about what you're passionate about. So reach out to us on social media or send us an email, and we'll get you on the podcast. And we don't just want to get guests. We just want to hear from our audience. We know you download our episodes, but we'd like to see more than just a like on social media. We want to see some pictures of you listening to our podcast in the lab or listening to our show out in the field, or just rocking some of our fisheries podcast merchandise. Or if there's something that you enjoyed hearing on the podcast and it stuck with you, send us a tweet with that in there. And we'd just love to hear some sort of feedback about you listening to our show and what you enjoyed from it. So, I mean, we're nearing an hour and probably getting enough of my ramblings now. But I hope that the message of this podcast has come through that this is an amazing occupation that we've all chosen or landed in. And I hope that you want to share that passion with people, whether it's via podcast or the person standing behind you in the grocery store line or even your family members. Just share your passion with people. It's that simple. Just share your story. That was my message when I was interviewed by Julie and Brett, was share your story. And as always, you don't have to share your story. We just appreciate you listening to our podcast, and you can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a contribution through Patreon or by rocking some of that awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and other gear available on Teespring. And don't forget, 25% off through the end of the year. I don't know what the promo code is yet, but look in the show notes and it will be in there. So I am Nick Kramer, and on behalf of everyone at the Fisheries Podcast, thank you for listening to the 100th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember,
we as scientists should never feel like that we're better than anyone else. Not everything is black and white, and we have to be smarter than our data.
Never forget who you're working for.
Sportsmen as a whole have a debt to our environment.
Honestly, you know, it's kind of one of those corny answers, but I think that's pretty high up there.
Try to wash your research of any like implicit bias that you might have.
We are fishes, data first, and no hatcheries.
We need to respect fish because fish are awesome.
Wear your kill switch lanyard when boating around those pesky silver carp.
They have a voice and they can make a difference in natural resource policy.
Nature is nature.
To share your passion, to share your story.
Keep invaders out of the Great Lakes.
Get outside.
It's not about your ability to exploit the natural resource, it's about the natural balance.
Support wild fish.
Science doesn't have to be boring.
Be skeptical.
Pay attention to water.
Question everything.
People look outside of their own little bubble when it comes to trying to learn things about fish populations.
You know, native fish are really important.
So, you know, my motto is always keep going and growing.
And I'm all about excellence and looking for ways, realizing that none of us are perfect, but we all should be striving to be better. So making our best better.
Fish matter, so do rivers, and we should endeavor to minimize our impacts and step up our efforts to restore them.
Wildlife conservation, fisheries conservation is incredibly important. It's something that people value, and it's something that receives very directed funding.
Native fish communities have great value.
Plastic is a major issue.
You know, sustainability matters.
Find a job you love doing.
Get out there and go discover things.
Leave absolutely no stone unturned.
So we really do try very hard to take people's input into consideration, but ultimately we have to make a decision.
Don't think alligator gar are trash fish, but think of them more as important roles to this ecosystem.
It's all connected, and we can work together to find solutions.
Bigmouth buffalo is not a carp, and also that they're native to North America.
Don't be afraid to take a risk.
That we as fisheries scientists and researchers have an obligation. We have a responsibility to do our very, very best to communicate our work and the value of our work to the public.
When you see an opportunity, take it.
Think large scale and on an ecosystem level. And
you know, I think it's simple. Some people fish their whole lives and they don't even realize it's not the fish they're seeking.
Our diverse human perspectives are important in the grand scheme of things.
Think outside the box. Don't be afraid of failure. Try new things all the time.
Stay curious. Stay excited. You can learn from every mistake and every failure if you're just open to it, and just be nice to each other.
Approach more things from a more positive point of view.
That everything touches the ocean. No matter what we do, we are all connected to each other and connected to the ocean, and we need to live like that is true.
To be true to yourself as a scientist.
Stay passionate, stay weird, and then don't be afraid to relocate.
We need to make sure that at least some of our research, if not a lot of our research, is of use to state agencies, because they're the ones that are going to institute the changes that we might think are needed.
Rivers change.
Well, there are three components to a fishery. It's habitat, fish, and people. I think as biologists, we have the fish part pretty well in hand. And we've made great strides on people management. But habitat management is still in its infancy, and it is the most critical part of that three fishery component. And that's where our energy needs to go.
Combine your passions in life with the things that matter.
The costs of plastic are not the cost that you pay at the register.
Be curious.
The word data is a plural noun. Data are, not data is.
Sharing is caring.
We are all in this together.
Look to social science.
It's important to understand the behaviors of animals in their environment.
People are genuinely trying their best. Give them a break.
Diversity leads to resilience.
Think beyond themselves.
Science is for everybody, whether you think you're good at it or not.
De-jargonize your fisheries communication.
Never pass up an opportunity to gain firsthand experience and to be brave.
It all requires a bit of humility and pause.
Know your local fisherman.
Pick up your trash and get a job.
If you want something badly enough, you're going to get it.
Sharks are not a threat to people.
The importance of a good ecological education.
We shouldn't really all be worrying about achievement, but we should be worrying about competence.
There are trout in the desert. There's fish in the desert, and they're super cool.
We all have great ideas. We all have great perspectives, and we all are working towards the same goal.
The opportunities invasive species can give us from a research standpoint.
In science, Black representation matters. Indigenous representation matters.
The world has wicked problems, and that it can be solved only through transdisciplinary thinking and learning.
Be more compassionate.
Generally, our freshwater ecosystems are fragile.
Don't just use statistics, but actually learn statistics.
Not only dams and weirs exist on our waterways, it's important to also think about our smaller infrastructure that's associated with things like roads that are also more pervasive and less understood in our waterscapes.
Fish need to migrate between the sea and the source, between the sea and the mountains, in a free-flowing river.
To just believe in yourself.
Listen to diverse voices.
You never know what somebody's been through.
The problem is almost certainly more complicated than you think it is, but the solution might be less complicated than you think it is.
You shall love thy downstream neighbor.
Take opportunities where you can.
All fish deserve our respect and our attention.
To listen carefully to everyone.
As the great Bob Barker said, make sure you spay and neuter your pets. So my one pointer principle would be to make sure you share your story. I need to listen to my own advice on this. People have really interesting backgrounds and a lot of great backstories outside of just being a great fish biologist or a fish researcher or even undergraduate students. There's a lot of just really neat, interesting people out there in this field. I mean, Julie, you wanted to share some of that backstory of some other people. So hopefully by doing that on this show and on Twitter, people start to realize that it's not just science nerds that become biologists. It's everyday common people that grew up fishing farm ponds or playing in streams in South Carolina or grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. It's not your avid fishermen that are out on the water every day. It's just common people that love fish that go into this field and do cool things like rock climbing and can pick up a penny with a forklift. So just sharing your story gets that information out there.
Give my little guys a shout out.
Yeah, I wish I could speak whale. I'd probably get better tips.
It's a pretty cool thing.
Being good biologists, you know, we decided to kill everything that we saw.
Why would we be doing these things?
Oh, yeah, my bad.
Oh, let the carp whisperer get it out of the net.
Great, let's put him in the neutron beam.
That's funny.
Oh, boy.
Fish are nature's gift to the humans.
Ooh, you got me with that one. I'm, like, questioning my whole life.
Hooray!
Does that make sense?
I have no idea.
You're the expert at this. I'm just the newbie, so you tell me.
Oh no, this is where I get unmasked.
Holy mackerel.
So that was a very long rambling synopsis.
That was a lot.
Do you want any more? Because I could keep talking about them.
There's not much more to say. That's almost all the words in the English language.
Do you want any more?
Oh God, there's so many of them.
So many.
They're all amazing.
Ooh, the blue-green algaes.
Southern Indiana, did you grow up close to Santa Claus?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not too far from Santa Claus. My cousin actually used to play clarinet in one of the German bands at Santa Claus.
Oh, that's fucked up. Somehow that doesn't surprise me, though.
He's kind of like Gandalf or something.
People are finally catching on. Been saying it for years.
I've lost all my self-respect, but I'm having the time of my life.
God, I feel like I'm very exposed right now. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to anybody before.
Man, my mind is starting to go blank.
Have a good holiday. This is close to winter solstice, which means that the frost fish, otherwise known as tomcod, are just starting their spawning run. They come out of the ocean, they spawn up in fresh water. They're a migratory anadromous fish, and we're just starting our surveying this week. So they're a really cool fish. Check them out.
Hopefully it's a good episode.
I think people really like it. So I know I had a lot of fun talking about it.